today on Doomed. Here it is, the big 200th episode of Doomed with Matt Binder, and I am your host, of course, Matt Binder. It's hard to believe that it's been over about 4 years now. I've been doing this show 4 years of Doomed, talking about the latest right-wing conspiracy theories, misinformation, movements, whether it be, you know, your everyday average Republican, QAnon, white supremacist groups. Literally, it's all the same now. And joining me on this 200th episode of the show, let me pull us up on the screen. The man who, quite frankly, can be blamed for all of this, the one who the one who brought me into the podcasting, live streaming world, oh boy, 11 years ago now.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, yeah. Sam Cedar of The Majority Report. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Thanks for having me, Matt. I'm getting a little bit of feedback. Oh, no, there it goes. Congratulations, 200 episodes. Holy crap. And I am very, very sorry that I in any way contributed to your what your life is now. I apologize.
It's all good. It's all right. It's all right. I forgive you. anyway, you know, I originally actually wanted to have you on for the 100th episode of the show. And then literally the 100th episode just happened to fall in right. I believe it was like either the like the second or third week of like when everything shut down in March 2020.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, not really in a celebratory mood. I think that episode ended up being something about the coronavirus, obviously. And it's good that now, you know, I was like, I'll have Sam back. I'll have Sam finally on the show when things are better. It's good now, two years later.
Better-ish.
Well. We've eradicated it obviously in this country, and now you're on the show. That's
excellent. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the word is that Hochul is going to get rid of the mask mandates. Right. I don't know how that's going to impact schools in New York City, but you know, there's a sense that, you know, I think a lot of it's aspirational. You know, like maybe if we sort of behave like it's over, it'll go away. But certainly the infections are going down. So we're pretty close. It's as good as it's, I think we're about to enter a period that's going to be as good as it's been in 2 years. We'll see how sustainable that is.
Right, right. You know, how has your family been during all this? I mean, we actually ended up going, we went 2 years almost without getting sick. And then the end of 2021, we all got it. Me, my partner, the two kids. Luckily, we all were okay. But it was, you know, it took a lot out of us. Like it was, the kids actually were lucky. We all got lucky in terms of like, just like maybe a day or two of fever. But I got the worst of it actually. My back was like really bad for weeks, and I actually like the first day it went out, I couldn't move. And, wow. You know, I was talking to Matt Leck, and he said he was experiencing the same thing right after he got COVID.
Yeah, no, fortunately, no one in my family got it. My kids, myself, my ex-wife, I was lucky. Both my parents would be very susceptible, but they got very lucky as well. Knock on wood, hope to maintain that. You know, it's, I think everybody is going through some level of low grade, stress and strain. But you know, my kids seem to be doing, more or less okay. It's tricky navigating this when you're divorced and sharing custody. It adds another layer of complication, to things. But you know, it's not dramatically different, I think, than probably everybody's going through some measure of that difficulty, you know, throughout this time. So knock on wood, we're doing as well as, you know, I feel like I could hope. So, right. You know, it's been a tough time, and, you know, hopefully, but Saul said to me the other day, and obviously your kids similar dynamic. I mean, well, very different. I mean, but Saul says to me, he said, he turned to me and he goes, you know, one quarter of my life has been in this pandemic. And he goes, and that doesn't even include when I was like one, because I don't remember when I was one. And I was like, yeah, you're right.
That's very astute, actually, for him to recognize that. I mean, that's, my son has not said that, and he might be Saul's age. My son's almost seven, close.
Yeah, well, Saul's almost nine. Oh, you know, okay. So I mean, it's difference. That actually between 7 and 8 is a big developmental year. Right. And then of course it was also even numbers, so it was easier to say quarter.
Right.
Not taking anything away from him, but he's good. He's good at math.
My daughter was born in the spring of 2019, so she pretty much her entire life has been this. She didn't get to really interact with many kids. She wants to, like, she sees us wearing the mask and she requests one, even though she doesn't need one because she's under the age where they usually require one. But that's the thing. Let me talk to you about that really quick. I didn't think about, we talk about COVID, but I want to ask really quick because it dovetails into like the right and everything. You hear so many of these like anti-vaxxers and right-wingers basically push the idea that like, what are we doing to our kids with these masks? Let me ask you, Sam, as a parent of two kids, do they give a shit about wearing these masks?
I mean, I can only speak for my kids, but no, they don't. I mean, you know, I think, you know, Mila doesn't, I think she's, you know, she doesn't love it, but she's as vigilant, if not more so, than her parents. And Saul is like, you know, I said to him, I mean, he's, you know, he's nervous about COVID, but it's not, you know, an irrational, you know, a fear. And he'll go and he'll play with his friends and he'll, you know, we don't go many places, but we will go places, you know, and there are some, depending on who it is we see, he will take off the mask in their house, but generally he will wear his mask. And, I mean, I remember one time we were going, I think it was for, the Yom Kippur breakfast, not even this year. I think it was the year before. And we were doing it on somebody's roof. Maybe it was this year, last September. And I'm like, are you, yeah. And I said, we were doing it on their roof or on their, yeah, maybe not their roof, but a roof. And, so it was outside and I was like, are you excited to go? And he goes, well, if you hadn't noticed, I'm unvaccinated. And I was like, well, yeah, you'll be fine though. And wear a mask. And we went and, you know, he was fine. But in terms of wearing a mask, no, he wears a KN95, that's, you know, kid size. And he's pretty vigilant about it. And he's complained. You know, there are times that we've been in the car where I'm like, dude, you can take your mask off. And he's like, actually, I like it because it keeps my face warm. And that's the one thing actually about outdoors that I've noticed too, is that I walk to work and I'm like, I could just do this. And it actually, when you start getting into like the teens and the 20s, wearing a mask is not a bad thing, actually.
Right. I might do it every winter, honestly. I've noticed the same thing. It's better than a scarf, even.
Yep, it really is. It's pretty good. And you can just drop it and this and that. And so, I mean, I try and wear mine as little as I can, but I don't go into places without wearing a mask. And I don't really fret too much about other people wearing it. If I'm going in with the KN95 and I'm going into the supermarket or the, you know, the drugstore or something like that, I'm not in any given place that I have to worry about it. I think the mask picks me, you know, has me covered.
Right. Yeah, I could also say as a parent that my son thinks absolutely nothing of it. He just literally wears it. He's got like one, we bought him like this like lanyard thing that goes on the mask so he could just literally drop it off his face. Doesn't even need it on his ears and it's like a necklace. So he has it on and when he goes outside, he takes it off. And like I said earlier, my daughter, 2 years old, we're all going out and we all got our masks on like we normally do. She wants hers on. Like she wants to be part of the whole thing. She doesn't even care. Yeah. It's just ridiculous.
And I guess, you know, I mean, I guess it's sort of like, you can look at it like on some level it's sad, but on another level, like, you know, you could have said the same thing about shirts. Like, right. Look at this. Right. You know, the kids feel like they're going out, you know, now we all wear shirts, and it used to be we would walk around without shirts. And now all the kids feel like they have to cover up just like the parents do. That's a shame. I mean, it's just an inconvenience. It's an annoyance. But it actually makes a significant difference in terms of, like, I think, keeping you safe. So, you know, it is what it is. One thing I did notice, I coached my son's assistant coach, I should say, my son's little league or minor league team last year. And, you know, I play softball, and I'm used to, like, getting frustrated when people blow it. But when you're playing with, like, seven-year-olds, particularly seven-year-olds who missed the year, they're not very good. They're not very good. In the first couple of games, I felt myself getting frustrated, and I was mumbling under my breath, like, Jesus, are you serious? And, you know, you forget, they're little kids. But the good news is, like, I have my mask on for the league because the league required it. And I realized, like, oh, nobody knows I said anything. And, you know, so we don't have, like, parents on the side going, like, what's wrong with that coach muttering at, like, how bad the kids are or something. And so it took me a little while to adjust that. But, you know, there are times where it's, you know, an upshot, I guess.
Right. Yeah, I just think the whole backlash against it is amazing. Like, because it's even not so much even just the like, we're angry that there's, like, that businesses are able to make their own, like, decide they don't want someone in there following their own policies. Like, it's even beyond that, where it's like, they even get mad if you, like, choose to wear a mask. It's, like,
yeah.
So bizarre. Like, what happened to, if the whole idea is, like, everyone have their own personal choice? What's up?
I think it is, I mean, it's not hard for me to sort of, at the very least, sort of get around what the idea is, which is, like, they want to not feel any type of nagging doubt about what they're doing. And, you know, having heard me pontificate about Rush Limbaugh for so many years, that was what one of Limbaugh's, like, what one of, and anybody who's watched the Majority Report has probably heard me say this 1,000 times, but Limbaugh, one of, like, his big projects were always basically saying, feel no doubt. Don't ever doubt yourself. Don't ever question yourself. You know, block that stuff out. And when somebody else is wearing a mask or doing something, like, you know, publicly, you know, signifying that they're taking this seriously, or they're actually, or there's a, you know, it's both a symbol. Like, I mean, because I see somebody with a mask in a context, like, I'm like, okay, I feel confident that that person takes it seriously. I don't know what their behavior is outside of this one moment we're interacting. But I get this, that this person takes it seriously. So I have a vague notion, you know, it's a, you know, it is literally virtue signaling to me. It is signaling that I take this seriously, and you can have at least some confidence that I'm not, you know, walking around maskless in, you know, in a concert hall, you know, with strangers and stuff like this. And so, you know, so, but the opposite of that is that other people are saying, like, I take this seriously, and it creates a slight creeping doubt in these people's minds, which they resent and they hate. And it is because, and that is almost like definitionally what it is to have a conservative reactionary mind, which is like, I can't have any doubt that I am in the right in this situation. Like, I have seen people get upset at other people saying, like, you know, the rule is you're supposed to wear a mask in here. And, but in situations where a mask is voluntary, I just don't, I've never seen anybody go, like, you know, how dare you, you know, like the supposed mask scolding happens, as far as I can tell, on people who are not wearing masks. Yes. And resent. And look, I spend a decent amount of my time, and certainly during COVID, you know, upstate, and it's a rural area. And I spend a decent amount of time at like hardware stores and, you know, folks who grew up in rural areas. And, you know, there's a lot of people who are just like, I'm not wearing a mask. And I have only seen people who are not wearing masks take issue with people who are wearing masks and not vice versa. Now that's just my, you know, my experience, but, you know, because to some extent it's like, look, both of us are in a room. Whatever the odds are that one of us have COVID are, if we're both wearing masks, the one without COVID is more protected than if that person alone is wearing a mask. But if that person's just wearing a mask, the person without COVID is wearing a mask, and it's a high quality mask, you can be in that same space for an extended period of time,
right?
Hour, 2 hours, depending on, you know, what kind of viral load the other person has, and still be pretty safe. And so, you know, it's taken a while for the data to make that clear, but that's basically the situation. Now that's not 100%, but that's, you know, odds are that's the case. And so, you know, it is what it is. You don't want to wear a mask. I mean, I don't know if I'm going to invite you in my house,
right?
But, you know, suit yourself.
Right. So let's move on to the next topic. I wanted to talk, I mean, you probably have, I've seen you on TV talk about it. You might be sick and tired of talking about it. But I do want to talk with you about Joe Rogan. Because I have a very different little like discussion I want to bring up. Because to me, yes, it's a, you know, it's a problem when, you know, the biggest podcast on the planet is spreading this sort of misinformation out there about COVID. But, you know, Ben Shapiro's podcast is pretty big. You know, all the other right wingers' podcasts are pretty big. They all dabble in the same sort of COVID conspiracy theories or questioning the science. But for me, the issue here, and I brought this up on Twitter, and of course, the only people who had a problem with it were right wingers, is that Rogan and his audience are under the impression that the show, at least when they talk about politics, I'm not going to talk about when Rogan talks with entertainers or other comedians or whatever, when they talk about politics, he is a right-wing talk show. There is no, like, they're under the impression that they're getting some sort of moderate centrist opinion, and they believe it for some reason with Rogan, whereas obviously the other shows clearly label themselves and categorize themselves in a specific category. You know, there was some list going around that listed a bunch of Rogan's guests and who was on the right and who was on the left. And it wasn't a very, you know, full list. It was only a couple of, you know, I think 100 episodes the guy looked at. And the left-wing list wasn't filled up with everyone he's had, like Bernie Sanders or whatever. But the right-wing list was clearly, it looked like it was quite clear that he's had mostly right-wingers on his show. And they had a problem, the Rogan fans, with people like Jordan Peterson and Barry Weiss and Tim Pool being labeled as right-wingers. They were saying, right, no, those are Rogan's leftist guests. You got to put them on the left column. They're on the, there's no other show on the planet that talks about right-wing politics that I can think of that would say, like, oh, no, Ben Shapiro's guest, he wasn't talking like Matt Walsh isn't a right-winger who was talking to Ben Shapiro. That, you know, it's so bizarre, that dynamic that happens on with Rogan and his fans.
Well, you know, Dave Rubin was doing that for a while, but Dave Rubin was doing it consciously. Like, I mean, hopefully, you know, most people know, you know, my perspective on Rogan, but it is, I do not think that Rogan thinks about these things. Okay. Like Ben Shapiro does.
Right.
Stephen Crowder does.
Yeah.
I think even Dave Rubin, to the extent that he has the faculty to think about these things, you know, I don't think he thinks about it in a very sophisticated way, but he certainly knows what he's doing, at least, you know, to a certain extent. My take on Rogan is that he doesn't really have a clue about this. I mean, I think I agree with you that that is very problematic for anybody from the center to the left, that Tim Pool, that those ilk of people can go on there and be perceived as representing the left, because of course they're saying more or less the same thing as the people on the right are. It's just that it creates this sense of like, well, the center must be somewhere between Tim Pool and, you know, Steven Crowder or something. And yeah, I do think that's a problem from the perspective of the left. I don't know that it's, you know, that Rogan is conscious of that. Let me put it this way. I don't think Joe Rogan has a political project. I think Joe Rogan is in over his head. There was a great tweet thread. I can't even remember who did it, but I read it off on the Majority Report. That really just outlined, and I know this. I mean, I've known Rogan for 30 years, I guess, actually, now that I think about it. He was in the same Boston comedy, you know, at the same time I was. We weren't particularly friends. We played softball, pickup softball. But I would see him perform quite a bit. And, you know, he was of a different sort of school of comedy than I was. And he was very sort of like, a Boston, you know, his comedy, I think it's pretty obvious, right? Like, you know, sort of like just sort of, you know, somewhat reactionary, not terribly, necessarily thoughtful.
He's better on the mic as a podcaster than a comedian.
I mean, his comedy was, you know, this was like at the end of the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s. Like, you know, you could go in with a lot of attitude. And if you were big and brassy and, you know, projected a lot of confidence, that type of comedy was still working at that time. And I don't think he really, you know, he just started his podcast getting high with his, friends who were similarly, dispositioned as he was, which is sort of like a Boston, I don't know. I mean, I want to say townie, but I mean, I know that at times I, you know, was considered a townie when I grew up in Worcester, but the idea just being like, a little bit ignorant about these things and just sort of knee jerk. And, I don't think he's terribly thoughtful. And, I think that, like, you know, the worst part about, that compilation, like, I'm very sympathetic actually to, the idea that particularly at the time that he was doing it, that you, are quoting comedians. I mean, Lenny Bruce had an extended routine about the N word, where his whole idea was the way that you reappropriate or disempower the N word is if, I think it was like, I don't know. I think it specifically, if I remember the bit correctly, it was like, you know, Kennedy comes out and says, I want you to meet my new Secretary of State. He's, you know, he's a N word. And, you know, this guy, cabinet secretary, was an N word, and this, and just N word, N word, N word, N word as a way of like sort of, disempower the word. We have a different understanding of the way, and really, frankly, a better understanding of history, that informed that word, today. And, you know, but I'm sympathetic with him having used that word in the way that he did and the fact that he's apologized for it, because I think that's all you can do in that situation. I'm less sympathetic about his story about going to see Planet of the Apes, frankly.
Right.
Like, that seems to me to be,
pretty racist.
You know, that's not, you know, a semantic issue or an issue about disempowering language or quoting somebody. That's just like your ignorance coming out and associating, you know, black people with the Planet of the Apes or with Africa for that matter. And I think that's a little problematic, and I think that's indicative of maybe, like, you know, maybe, you know, whatever his life experience, his upbringing, you know, who's to say what's in somebody's heart. But I don't think he has a project, and I think he got, surrounded by a bunch of people. And at one point, you know, Michael and I tried to get on Rogan's show. Maybe it was, I can't remember. Maybe, well, actually, no, I do. I could probably figure this out. It was sometime around, I think, 2018. I wanted to go out to LA on a regular basis. I was involved with someone out there at the time, and I was looking for some reasons to do a business trip, to be honest, if I'm going to be totally frank. And so, you know, I emailed him and I had gotten connected to him through, you know, mutual friend. And I think at one point, like, he sort of just sort of semi punted. And then that was the end of it. And it wasn't like he wasn't aware of me. I mean, I came up in discussions he had with, I think it was Brett Weinstein or one of those Weinstein guys, and maybe somebody else, as they were talking about me going after Ruben. And I think at one point he was basically just, you know, for whatever reason, you know, didn't want to have me on there. But I don't think he has a project. I think he just, like, was getting good feedback from the right. And I think he's more inclined to be dispositioned towards them, see certain people as being a little soy boyish and that type of thing. And I think he's in over his head. And I think, you know, he went from smoking pot with his buddies to smoking pot with MMA guys to smoking pot with celebrities to then all of a sudden, you know, getting a little Freddie Prinze syndrome and feeling like he couldn't hear the laughter anymore and needed to get into sort of deeper thoughts. And you know what? I'm sorry. Like, dude, if you're going to do that, you got to look at how many people are listening to your show and realize that you have a responsibility. You have a responsibility to society. You have a responsibility to your audience. And if you're not willing to do the reading, if you're just going to say to your producer, Google this, Google that, tell me the top headline, then you're a fuck up. And you deserve the criticism. And if you are a company that's going to pay for somebody to do this on your platform exclusively, then you as a company need to take responsibility for that as well. And so, you know, there's two different sort of like categories here. There's the category of a company that is profiting off of creating disinformation and putting it out there and being this irresponsible with this platform deserves a tremendous amount of criticism and should be hammered. And if people want to walk away from them and not pay them money to do this, then they have every right to do that. And that's not censorship.
Right.
That's called, like, I don't want to put money in the pocket of somebody who is doing destructive things to society.
Right.
And then the other sort of category is, as, you know, people who are trying to promote a specific ideology or range of ideology in our society, specifically, you know, center to the left, we look at Rogan and say, okay, this is a problem because this is another source of right-wing talking points that he may or may not know that he is. He's definitely no Crowder. Like, Crowder knows exactly what he's doing.
Right.
And is out there with a project. Rogan is not. And so, you know, there's different answers as to how you approach him or approach that problem. And that's a different one as well on some level. And again, there's no censorship here.
Right.
Joe Rogan could get kicked off of Spotify, could get kicked off of YouTube, could get kicked off of iTunes, and he could set up his own website and get more distribution than either one of us combined will get over the rest of our lives.
Right.
That's not censorship. That is, you know, consumer reaction. And, you know, I don't think that's the most effective means of change necessarily, but nobody who supports Joe Rogan, and many, many people who don't support Joe Rogan, have any leg to stand on when they talk about consumers not spending their dollars somewhere and other people complaining about it. It's just absurd. Right. It's an absurd concept. And, you know, if you see somebody defending on those grounds that this is censorship, you know they're full of shit.
Right.
That they actually are the ones who do have a much more thought out and deliberate political project.
Right. It's a good old fashioned boycott when people start canceling and this is the same thing the right does all the time when a company angers them by like running a commercial with like a gay couple or something. Like they literally
it's been going on for decades.
Yeah, right.
Decades.
Right.
They pioneered this.
Right.
The Christian right pioneered this. They were protesting Disney over, you know, or Pixar or whoever it was with, you know, Lenny the Shark or whatever that was, or Shark's Tale or whatever it was. They were saying that the dolphin, I mean, I remember calling them in 2005, you know, some of these right-wing organizations, they were saying that, you know, Lenny the Shark or somebody was like cross-dressing and it was teaching kids to be gender neutral or whatever it was that they had sort of divined was going on in these things. I mean, this has been going on for decades on the right. Decades.
Right. I mean, if people want to cancel their Spotify subscription, let them. I mean, I just want to say too, like, is that like this is another thing I witnessed. I actually didn't say anything about the actual boycott or the censorship claims about Rogan. My tweets about Rogan were simply, well, A, I laughed at the fact that he was literally apologizing every other day at this point. And then B, the idea that he has this well-balanced show of both left-wing ideas and right-wing ideas. And that's all I mentioned. And then just the stream of right-wingers come into my Twitter. Oh, you're trying to boycott him and censor him? I have a Spotify subscription. I haven't even canceled it because in my personal opinion, I don't think it's not going to do anything, in my personal opinion. But if people feel like their $10 canceling it does something, then power to them. And if Joe Rogan's not – if Joe Rogan continues to stay with Spotify, it is what it is. I'll continue to criticize what he says and does and the amount of airtime he gets and amount of listeners he has. If he does get removed from Spotify, I won't care about that either. And I'll continue to criticize whatever platform he goes to or his own, whether he sets up his own server and continues to say whatever it is that he says.
Yeah. I mean, it's called critique. And the idea that somehow that is censorship. You know, when I went on Chris Hayes's program and I was accused of saying to censor him, and it's like, wait, what? Like, I don't think, frankly, that, you know, the presidential spokesperson should be weighing in on it. I think it would have been better for her to say, like, this is not our business. We wish that in general, that if people have a large platform or even a small platform, but it's obviously more impactful if they have a large platform, that they do a minimum amount of homework before they decide that they can, that they are in a position to espouse these things. But listen, I do the same thing with Nate Silver, with his bullshit, or David Leonhardt in the Times. Like, you know, it's just nobody pays attention to it in the same way because they don't have a natural constituency. But the right has adopted Rogan in many respects. And you know, that the whole IDW thing, that was, it just so happened that, you know, they were kindred spirits in that regard. So I don't know. I think there's a lot of like, bullshit around that. And I think like you can find different, somebody could do a taxonomy of the type of people who are going to defend, Rogan in this instance, ranging from like disingenuous, you know, from like just a fan of Rogan. I think he's a good guy. And, you know, he seems like a nice guy and a guy I'd like to hang with and get high with or whatever, through to like, you know, people talking about authoritarianism or censorship or, you know, some bullshit like that and just how disingenuous they could be.
Right. I have a quick story you'll enjoy. So in those replies to my tweet about Rogan not having on that many left wingers on his show, someone said, what are you talking about? I've heard episodes with him talking to Abby Martin and Sam Cedar. And I retweeted that. And a bunch of my followers replied like, oh, can you link me up to that Sam Cedar episode? I can't wait to listen. And they ended up replying to everybody after getting called out and said, oh, I'm sorry. I meant David Pakman.
Oh, well, I mean, that was Pakman's plan all along when he stole my backdrop.
Right.
Yeah. The classic. Yeah. Right. No, that was talk about somebody who's planning something out. That was whole part of Pakman's whole game plan.
Right. No, I do have, I agree that Rogan is, and this is the last point I really want to make about this, but I agree with you that Rogan's not like plotting this or planning this or thoughtful about this in the same way that, you know, other right-wing shows are. He's just someone who's fallen into this and is digging himself deeper and deeper over the years. But I don't understand why, especially being that he did specifically bring you up and Michael Brooks up on the show once before. I think he called him Michael Roberts and then went online, tweeted at him to apologize. So he definitely knew who Michael Brooks was. And to that tweet, like Kyle Kulinski, who's been on Rogan's show before, I believe it was Kyle Kulinski, tweeted at Rogan, said, "You got to have Michael on. He's great, and he'll really speak to your fans." And Michael, as I know, I don't know what he would think of Rogan nowadays, but Michael at the time was a fan of Rogan. I don't quite understand, why he's so against having someone like you or Michael at the time on the show. If it wasn't for him, just who is he? Is he afraid of offending his friends? Is he like, it just doesn't make any sense to me. If this is a guy, like, it's not like you guys aren't big enough either. Like, if you look at some of his guests, like, sure, you're not like as big as, I don't know, whatever celebrities he has on or, you know, the biggest right winger talking heads. But
well, this was like 3 or 4 years ago, right, too, where obviously it's a different. I don't know why he didn't have Michael on. I think in terms of why he didn't have me on was because those guys from the IDW, like Sam Harris and Rubin, at the time and Weinstein and that crew said, don't have him on. I mean, I don't have proof of that. I wasn't sitting there, but I mean, you can listen to the conversations where I came up. I think it was a couple of different ones, and it was all around that. I think he brought me up to Pacman. I think it was Pacman, where he said something about, you know, and it was all stuff that he was parroting from those IDW guys. And I think it was a combination of feeling like they said, don't have him on. You're just going to give him oxygen or whatnot, which is, you know, probably true.
Right.
They would have given me, oxygen, and it would have helped my show, I would imagine, on some level. I don't think there's a huge audience for me there, you know, but I think it would have undercut some of the stuff that he had been hearing before. And I think also, look, I'm not the first person to say this, but I can be a bit of a dick. And I don't really, I think that I don't do a great job of hiding that. And I think, you know, as well as anybody, that, I don't feel comfortable doing things that are exclusively to help my show or, you know, or to promote myself. And that is, I think, threatening to some people because, you know, I was fairly satisfied, like when he's, you know, was having Kyle on and was having Pacman on and then Bernie, like, okay, there's some left voices that are getting to that audience. And I also have no reason to go out to LA anymore because that situation ended. and I was fine with that. But it's my way of saying that, like, I wouldn't have had a problem going on the show and offending him and never coming back on it. Let's put it that way.
Right.
And, you know, I'm not very good at, you know, people who have watched the Majority Report for a long time can see that this is a show that, like, I don't have people on because they have a big platform, and with the hopes of getting invited onto those shows. I just don't feel comfortable doing it that way. So I think to a certain extent that comes through a little bit. And I think, you know, maybe he was afraid of having Michael on or for a similar reason, maybe he imparted that, Michael would behave in that way as well. I have no doubt that Sam Harris was not appreciative of Michael's work. And other members of the IDW were not appreciative of his work. I think, frankly, would I have liked to have gone on? Sure, I think I would have had fun. But I think in terms of like depriving his audience, he probably deprived his audience more by not having Michael on, certainly, than he did me. I mean, that's my opinion. I think Michael would have been a little bit more of an interesting guest for his audience than I might
too.
Be.
Yeah.
I might be a little bit more less diplomatic.
right. You know, I've mentioned this when I'm on, I've mentioned this a few times on the Thursday show, whenever it comes up, when I'm on Majority Port on Thursdays for the Fun Half at 1 p.m. I don't know if you've heard it or if you've discussed this with anybody else or if you realize this, but I want to bring it up. After the wonderful, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare moment, where Steven Crowder ran away from you when you were tagged into that debate with Ethan right. Klein from H3H3. Tim Pool had a complete meltdown over it to the point where it was really bizarre. Did you see these clips of like Tim Pool having a meltdown over you going on, you doing that? Like, he had a complete mental breakdown. Like, the video's out there. Like,
really?
He was angrier than Steven Crowder. Like, he was so, he, there's this
at clip, me?
There's this clip of him yelling, "You've ruined it, Sam. You've ruined it." And I don't even know what he's talking about, honestly.
I ruined it.
Yeah, I don't know what he's even talking about. But he's so upset at the moment that you do that. And in his anger, he says that you want to know why you don't get invited to other shows. I know of shows where you're blacklisted.
I did hear that part. Maybe not necessarily from him, but like, I do remember somebody saying I was blacklisted. It didn't come as a complete shock to me.
Right.
That crew of people, I think, really understood that they needed to ignore my existence, that it would be better for them to do that. It's a circle jerk in many respects. And they know, and in fact, Rogan talked about this with Brett Weinstein, that I think I can't remember exactly the words he used, but he said, Cedar's trying to pick off Ruben like he's a wounded antelope. And I was like, that's actually, yeah, that's right. I am. I'm trying to take the straggling antelope and I'll take that one. And then I'll take the next one if I can. And, you know, I mean, it's not like this isn't what keeps me up at night, but it is something spend some time thinking about if I see an opportunity. I mean, I really wanted Ruben. You know, I set out, and I think, you know, you were, you know, I think you were still on the show. Like when Ruben, I think Ruben at one point announced he had a book coming out, and there was like, it ended up being a couple years later. But I was like, I remember saying in the office, when anybody goes to invite him on their show or review that book or do the fucking feature that we know that the, you know, whatever it is, they're going to do like they did with Glenn Beck and, you know, like the left wing or liberal press, both actually in many respects, love to write about right wingers. And when they go to do this, I want my fucking tweets or my videos or whatever defining Dave Rubin to come up without them having to Google, go past the first page. I mean, I think that was like, I want to be in that top five when you search for Dave Rubin, because I want people to understand that this guy is full of shit. Cause at that time he was pretending like he was of the left. He was saying stuff like, you know, I'm for single payer healthcare, but a smaller government, you know, that type of stuff. And so we set out to do that. And so when he, you know, finally signed with Beck and this and that, that project was over in many respects, because he had given up, you know, pretending he could only sustain that for so long, that he was, you know, the left had left him or whatever it was his catchphrase. I have no doubt that those guys, I mean, a blacklist seems like a strong word, but look, I was blacklisted from Fox for years. I would get booked by a show and that was like more and more marginal of the shows. And then when they would go, cause I know how they do this. Cause I'm quite convinced they had a blacklisted MSNBC too. I don't know who was on it, but they would go to central casting, and what would happen is, and I'm pretty sure it came from Hannity, there was a word in there like, oh no, this sets off a red flag. Can't have this guy on the network. And so the idea that, you know, the IDW guys, Shapiro and Rubin and Sam Harris and Brett Weinstein and the other Weinstein brother had all said, like, oh, we agreed that Sam Cedar's not going to come on the show. Like, that was not in any way a surprise to me.
Right.
I didn't realize, though, that he threw such a fit. And, you know, the ruined it thing, that makes total sense with what I know about Tim Pool, which is I know somebody who had worked with him before, had visited him at one point when his house was in, like, New Jersey. This was before he got the big, big compound and wherever he is, I guess somewhere near Washington, D.C. now. And they were taking him through, and he literally said, like, yeah, no, this is what I'm doing. It's great, because I don't even have to read anything. And he was just, you know, Tim Pool is about making money. And I'm sure his inclination is, you know, vaguely around these people are jerks. But I think for him, it's just like, I don't, you know, many of those people on the right don't feel any compulsion to actually do any work about the topic they're doing. I mean, you remember, that's what the Ken, Ken, and Ken show was all about.
Right.
We were just like, how do we take a day off, but actually still do the show? And
right.
It was like, oh, we'll pretend we're right-wing talk show hosts. And it was true. It was like, I just remember the first time we did that, we were all just like, whoa, this is fucking easy.
Right. Right. You just pick any news story and just get angry about the stupidest shit. And you don't have to even read it. You just look at the headline too. Even if, and this often happens in Tim Pool's own videos. It's put out all the time on Twitter where Tim Pool will read the headline, start getting angry about something. The video will go on for, you know, 5 minutes, 6 minutes, 7 minutes. And then the person who pulls the clip to post it on Twitter says, look at paragraph like, 6 or 5 in the very same article Tim Pool was getting angry over, and it completely debunks whatever he was getting angry about just from the headline.
Right, right. Yeah, I once heard there was a I remember where I was. I had my back was thrown out, and so I was going to do physical therapy in like 2000, like must have been about 2006, and I was listening to Limbaugh, and he was railing on this about he was like, these enviro fascists, you know, owl huggers, because there was a story in the late 90s, I think, about saving the spotted owl or something like this. You know, this story from Switzerland is just, you know, these environmental sickos. They have put a tin foil on the top of a glacier to pretend, you know, that it's global warming to keep this. And he starts to read into it, and he gets to the line, and environmentalists were very upset that the glacier, the ski resort did this or something. And it was like, it was actually the environmentalists who were complaining about the tinfoil, and the tinfoil was actually put on the mountain or the, you know, mylar or whatever it was, because it was getting too hot and the glacier was melting too much and they wanted to maintain the skiing. And he sort of like had to, we got to take a break. We'll be right back after this. And I just remember thinking, like, holy shit, he doesn't even read into these things. And he's just mad at his producer right now. And, and this is when I was doing, you know, talk radio. And I was like, I know exactly how this happened. And it's amazing to me. He's just like in autopilot. And that's what Tim Pool does. And he has just control over the whole thing. And he doesn't even care, because I think his audience doesn't really even pick up on it. And, you know, it's made him a very, very wealthy guy. And so, you know, to me, that doesn't speak very well about him.
Right, right.
But you know.
It is amazing, though, how, I mean, we've always discussed this, but I just want to bring it up for have it on air here. It is amazing, though, that, like, how big, like, there really is no equivalent to what the right is building online in terms of, like, their shows and the little, like, you know, media sphere where they're all going on each other's shows. There's nothing on the left that competes. And I don't get what, like, literally the Majority Report is probably the biggest, if not one of the biggest, that can actually go up against the right. Like, listen, I know there's other shows out there that are big, but they don't really engage either. It's bizarre. Like, you know, like you go after, and Michael did specific right-wing talkers all the time, and not just like in a general sense or when one of their clips went viral in the mainstream. Like, you, like the Majority Report always dug in to make sure that, like, man, you know, if they said something so egregious, you know, it needs to be called out, no matter, you know, even if it's not the big story going around Twitter or Facebook or whatever. Like, what do you think account, like, how does the left even, like, what can they even do at this point? Like, I look at it and I'm just like, you know, they're building their own little, like, even they complain they're getting deplatformed from Twitter and Facebook, whatever, but the big shows that continue to gain a foothold. I mean, look at Facebook's most engaged posts, their right, biggest
Dan Bongino.
Dan Bongino, Ben Shapiro, Breitbart, Steven Crowder starting to enter that top 10 list. I mean, this is the deplatformed right.
Yeah, I mean, they just have a much more. I mean, first off, their agenda is far more is far less dimensional than shows on the left, right? I mean, it's just like, you know, the Majority Report in many respects is schizophrenic. You know, like today, for instance, depending on when you tune into the show, you could either hear a PhD from the Quincy Institute, some of their funding comes from the Koch brothers, talking about Yemen and the dynamic between Saudi Arabia and Iran and UAE and the United States and the Houthis. Or you could hear a writer who is talking about how the Supreme Court threatens the non-delegation doctrine, which essentially allows, you know, the EPA to do its job, or, you know, how Breyer did a poor job in developing, you know, future toeholds for jurists to overturn what we're going to see over the next 10 or 20 years. Or you could be hearing, you know, me read off an IM about D's nuts on my face and, you know, and us, you know, mocking, I can't remember who we mocked today, but I'm sure it was incredibly sophomoric when we did it on some level, and everything in between. And it's, you know, the right, you know, and to a certain extent, like that is, you can find shows that are in every one of those silos on the left that are talking about, you know, sort of Marxist theory, or they're talking about, you know, completely ignoring electoral politics and their folk. And I'm not saying this in any way disparagingly, I'm saying it encouragingly, you know, looking at, you know, what you can do to build movements, or, you know, people are talking about, I don't know, John Rawls somewhere, or, you know, they're, and then doing every other aspect of it. But on the right, you tune in on any given day and there's, you know, they're all talking the same thing and they're all talking about it in the same way. And, and that's it. And they're, and part of it is that in many respects, they're getting their funding, if not from the exact same people, from the same ilk of people. Maybe they got their startup money that way, or maybe they've gotten, you know, they get a decent, you know, I get advertising from Hillsdale College or whatever it is. They've been platformed by these people, and they all fall in line. On the left, for the most part, like the compensation, you know, for some of us who are lucky enough to make you know, a decent living off it, part of that's the compensation, but the other part of the compensation on the left has always been, you know, how sound do other people think I am? And do people say, you know, say that the argument that I made is good, you know, or academic accolades, or, you know, I get a good review somewhere. On the right, the compensation comes in one form, and that is like, who's making the most money? And that's why, like, guys like Milo Yiannopoulos were on the top of the heap until they weren't.
Right.
Now and it's not like he was doing anything different, right? Like, it's not like people suddenly said, like, you know what? Actually, I've given a second thought to Milo Yiannopoulos. Wasn't he full of shit? No, it was just like he wasn't profitable anymore. And so he's gone. And that's the way it works on the right, because of that, in many respects, they're more effective because, and then there's problems with funding on the left. I mean, we've talked about this in the part, but that's, you know, this has been an ongoing issue, and the right is far less nervous. The money on the right is far less nervous about sort of pushing, a populism on the right, because that populism never interferes with their project.
Right.
The populism on the right is much more about nativism and some iteration of racism. And on the left, the populism is economic populism, and that is far more threatening to the money. And so that's why the money does not come. I mean, I can tell you that's like when the Democracy Alliance, I don't know if they still exist, but when they came around Air America, in addition to Air America being woefully mismanaged at various times by a series of jokers, I think there was just a general allergy to the idea of, like, I don't know, you know, radio, like, you know, it's a little bit, who's hearing this, you know? And so I think that's always going to be a problem.
Right. Right. Did you ever get a chance to listen to that anarcho-communist podcast, Sea of Thieves?
Was that you?
No, I wish that. I watch that clip all the time. It's great.
That's what I'm talking about. Like that, yeah. What was it? Well, I had to go like, see if these nuts or something, like, I can't remember what it was.
But
yeah, yeah. No, I got nailed so many times. I mean, it happens almost like every day now. Like, and half the time, like, Emma like will say to me, like, do you really not get what's going on? I'm like, look, I'm sorry. I didn't. She's still sort of amazed,
right,
at how easily I can get played or what I don't know references to.
It happens to her on Thursdays, so she could talk big all she wants, but it's happened to her before on Thursdays. She'll read the IMs and maybe not.
Maybe we should start clipping those.
Right. Sam, you have to come back on because I wanted to talk about the door to left. I wanted to talk about your saga with Cernovich, but that'll be a whole nother episode. Each of those topics could be. Sam Cedar of the Majority Report, thank you so much for joining me on this 200th episode.
I really appreciate you having me on. I have no right to be proud of you. That is reserved for Binder Dad. But I am nevertheless, like, it's impressive what you've done. Your reporting too. The work you did in print was also really impressive. And it makes me feel good that you're, you know, having this success and you're doing the work you're doing. It makes me feel good about myself. So, turning it back to me, but I really do appreciate you having me on, and, you know, keep up the good work, man.
Thank you, Sam. Hope you come back on soon, and, have a great night. And I guess I'll see the rest of the Majority Report crew on Thursday.
Yep. Yeah, of course. Oh, and we should also talk about, some other day. I'd like you to come and join us. Very soon, actually, in Brooklyn. I don't know if Bradley spoke to you, but we'll talk about that later.
Oh,
you don't need to do that right now.
Ooh, okay. All right, got it.
Intrigue.
Ooh. Take care, Sam. Have a great night.
No, all right,
your cat's walking around in the background. You got a big cat. He's big.
I got 32 pounds of cat in this house.
Jeez.
Two cats.
Oh, wow.
They're just, they go back and forth with the kids.
All right. So you got four kids now.
Yeah.
Take care, Sam.
See you, man. See ya. Thanks.
All right, folks. Don't go anywhere. I'll be taking calls. We have a lot more show for you. I will be talking about, if you enjoy Sam talking about Jimmy Dore and the Dorites like Jackson Hinkle, I have some of that coming up for you right now. I also will be talking about the trucker convoy, the astroturfed trucker convoy in going on in Canada right now. But first, let me quickly thank my patrons who joined over the past week. Now, here's the thing. This is the first episode of Doomed since I launched Scam Economy, my new show. And I'm using the same Patreon page, because it's just simpler. Patreon.com/Matt Binder. So I don't know who joined because they wanted to continue supporting Doomed. I don't know who joined because they discovered Scam Economy. For those who don't know, Scam Economy is my new show that's critical of the crypto, blockchain, NFT, Web3 space. Scam Economy. But I'm going to thank all the new patrons over the past week. Actually, 2 weeks, because this is the last time I had a live episode of Doomed. Right now. So people who have become patrons in recent weeks, let me give you a shout-out. Sean Zone, Kyle, Shabugan, PJB, Jaap Van, C. James, Raymond L., Barry B., Christina Dacey, Kate S., RPM Jr., Evan W., and OBO. Thank you so much for becoming patrons. Patreon.com/Matt Binder. You can also subscribe to this YouTube channel at youtube.com/Matt Binder. That's free. Twitch.tv/Matt Binder. If you want to give a one-time donation, you can leave a super chat right here, right now on the YouTube live stream. I will read the super chats on this show in just a second. You can also, if you're an Amazon Prime subscriber, you can go over to the Twitch channel at twitch.tv/Matt Binder, and you can literally become a modern-day Robin Hood. If you are already paying Amazon for an Amazon Prime subscription, you can give any Twitch channel of your choice every month a free paid subscription. It comes with your Amazon Prime subscription. You're basically taking money out of Jeff Bezos' pocket and gifting it to me at no extra cost to you. As Sam Cedar would say on the Majority Report, it's a win-win-win. Just go to your Amazon, I think it's amazon.com/gaming to connect your Prime account to twitch.tv. And then you can have this, you'll see the option to give me a free Twitch Prime subscription on twitch.tv/Matt Binder. For Doomed, all the links to all the podcasts, doomedcast.com. For Scam Economy, scameconomy.com. All the links are there. The YouTube channel is the same for both, youtube.com/Matt Binder, same with the Twitch. Leave Apple Podcast reviews. Leave Spotify reviews for both shows if you can. It's big support. It actually, you know, Scam Economy peaked. Scam Economy's been in like the top 20 tech charts on Apple Podcasts since it launched. And we were like in the top 10 for that first like week and a half. I can't thank you all enough for doing that. What else? Majority Port Thursdays. We're going to go to the second half of the show now. If you're watching on the live stream, stay right there. I'm going to take just a quick seconds break. You'll just see the screen say Doomed. And I'll be back in seconds. I'm just literally logging into the Skype call-in username. And that username, just open up Skype and search Doomed Live. And you'll see it. I think it actually comes up as Doomed Live_1 or something like that. That's what Skype gave me. But just search Doomed Live on Skype. You'll see the username pop up. You call into that number. I take people as they come in. There's no hold. I don't have a system to put you on hold. I just take whoever calls in. I talk with them. And then when we hang up, you got to call right back in. Whoever calls in first then, I take them. I will try to get through to as many people as possible. Again, Skype, open up Skype, search Doomed Live, you'll see it. It's free, by the way, to call via that. You don't have to worry about anything there. So cool. If you're sticking around on the live stream, or if you're a patron who gets this as the membership bonus, stick around or enjoy the rest. For the freebies listeners and people who are not watching the live stream, I will see you all next time on Doomed.